Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I was just reading something the other day, as the old timers called it, 100 drips a minute. Sort of like a, you know, like a heartbeat rate, where just, you know, just kind of at that pace.
That's Michael Bell. He's the chair of the grounds committee at the Hinkle Garten Farmstead. This time of year, he spends much of his time collecting sap and boiling it down to maple syrup. Today, he gives us a tapping demonstration that makes it seem easy enough to do in your own backyard. Then we visit the folks at Burton's Maplewood Farm, who play host to the annual National Maple Syrup Festival. In the kitchen, we use some local maple syrup to sweeten some turnips and pears, and then two green recipes, one for juice and one for a Japanese salad. Stay with us. Mia Partlow is here with the food news headlines.
The food world has been captivated by the scandal involving horse meat masquerading as beef in European grocery stores. The latest development came this week from the British supermarket chain Tesco, which acknowledged that its low-cost beef lasagna contained 60% horse meat. The horse meat has been traced to processing plants in Ireland, France, and England that may have purchased it from suppliers as far away as Poland and Romania. Stores in Ireland, France, and Sweden have also removed suspect products from their shelves. While some officials insist the adulterated meat poses no threat to human health, food safety campaigners aren't so sure. Some horses are given a powerful and dangerous veterinary drug called phenylbutazone, or bute. The concern is that the meat made it into the food system without being properly tested and cleared. The Indiana State Senate Agriculture Committee will soon begin hearings on a proposed ag gag bill. The proposed legislation will prohibit people from taking undercover pictures or video of farming operations from the inside. Proponents of the law say it will protect farmers' livelihood. Opponents contend that it will simply serve to prevent the truths of animal cruelty and unsanitary practices from being exposed. Farmers defending the bill argue that it serves the important purpose of protecting their proprietary techniques and information. Indiana is one of five states considering ag gag laws this year. The other four are New Hampshire, Nebraska, Wyoming, and Arkansas. Iowa, Utah, Kansas, North Dakota, and Montana already have ag gag laws on the books. The rush of ag gag policies in state legislatures follows several animal rights scandals in recent years that have resulted from hidden camera footage. And the USDA has announced its proposed rules governing the nutritional content of snacks, sodas, and meals sold in competition with federally subsidized school breakfasts and lunches. Under the proposed rules, schools must provide potable water at no charge, snacks with less than 200 milligrams of sodium per serving, and beverages with no more than 40 or 50 calories per 8-ounce serving. Marian Nessel of foodpolitics.com applauds the USDA for this move, saying, quote, "These rules are a big improvement and deserve much support," unquote. Read more about these stories on our website, where you can find links to the stories, eartheats.org. Also, Twitter and Facebook are the places to go to hear about the most up-to-the-minute food news items. Just search for Earth Eats.
Our food news headlines brought to us by Mia Partlow. Much appreciated.
My pleasure.
As extreme weather like flooding and drought takes land out of production in Nebraska, farmers and ranchers also are getting record prices for their products. So you might think that combination wouldn't bode well for conservation efforts. But as it turns out, some landowners in the state are actually managing to set land aside for environmental uses. Reporting from Nebraska for Harvest Public Media, Hillary Stowes Krause explains.
Along the winding road to and through Gracie Creek Ranch, a 25,537-acre yearling cattle ranch in central Nebraska, there are no houses in sight. No buildings, for that matter. Just acres and acres of gold and amber grass, punctuated by patches of sand and lines of barbed wire fence. And that's the way the owners of Gracie Creek Ranch want it to stay.
I was so excited to hear about this opportunity, and I mean, I thought that probably everybody would want to be doing this.
That's Lindsay Price, a fourth-generation rancher who owns Gracie Creek Ranch with her father Bob and brother Aaron. The opportunity she's talking about is a conservation easement. The Prices recently sold the largest such easement in Nebraska history, covering more than 40 square miles. The easement will be overseen by the Nebraska Environmental Trust. Funding came from private, state, and federal sources.
We're basically giving up some rights to farm and drill and wind development and
subdivision.
And subdivision. That's another huge one. To me, it gives us a chance to protect and preserve by giving up those rights.
Signing a legal contract to not develop or seek maximum production might seem counterintuitive, but in fact, for some, conservation practices have tangible economic benefits. The Price's easement, for example, was valued at nearly $1.8 million. And in a way, they're essentially being paid to keep doing what they've always done. Rich Nelson is with the Nebraska Office of the Natural Resources Conservation Service.
Most often, the first one that's thought of is a financial benefit because they are obviously compensated in most cases for the value of that easement. There's always a lot of different motivations by different landowners based on what their goals are for their property.
For the Prices, a main factor was knowing their land would be protected. Bob Price explains.
You know, I said I'm third generation, been in this business a long, long time. I think one of the biggest challenges I see in the near-term future is that a lot of people are going to say production agriculture cannot coexist with conservation practices. And it really saddens me because I feel just the opposite. I just feel very, very strongly about taking care of the land.
While the Prices have sought to help the environment by limiting development, a landowner in central Nebraska did the opposite.
If you listen, there is a noise to these things.
That's Jeff Evans, who owns farmland just outside Broken Bow, Nebraska. Evans is talking about wind turbines, four of which jut out from the ground on his property. They're part of a new 14,000-acre wind farm with 50 turbines. Evans, like the Prices, says he and his wife decided to participate in large part because of concerns about the environment.
I think everyone is thinking about, you know, again, 10, 20 years from now, where's the power going to come from, right? And how are we going to generate it?
But the money doesn't hurt either, Evans says.
Of course, all of the landowners have a really nice economic benefit that comes from having them on your place.
A subsidiary of an international power company will pay the landowners a total of about $540,000 per year for the 25-year lease. But rural conservation can also come in smaller doses. While the wind turbines dominate the landscape on Evans' property, a tiny orange sign reading Corners for Wildlife Project also is significant. For fields watered by pivot irrigation, about 7 or 8 acres in every corner are out of reach of water streams and simply don't produce as well. Groups like Pheasants Forever and Ducks Unlimited pay landowners to not farm certain parts of their property. Instead, the conservation groups help them plant native grasses to create breeding habitats.
We just like to see the birds, I mean, the pheasants and the wildlife around us and stuff. So for us, it's more about the wildlife than hunting.
Those kinds of financial incentives are key to increasing conservation efforts on farmland and ranchland, says Terry DeGroff. He's an ag financial management consultant from Burwell who helped with the Gracie Creek Ranch easement.
I think in the most part, it factors in significantly. They're trying to stay profitable, and it's just human nature that you think you got to take more. If there's some forage out there, you better take it or else it's going to waste. Many people, when they're struggling to make a living, are going to try to harvest as much as they can.
Still, according to environmentalists, the opportunities to capitalize on conservation may be greater than ever. And for some landowners, the conservation price is right. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Hillary Stowes-Krause.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. Burton's Maplewood Farm sits on 28 acres in Medora, Indiana. Every year in March, they host the National Maple Syrup Festival, proving that maple syrup isn't just for Vermont anymore. Daniel Orr spoke with two of the Burtons, Tim, the farm owner, and Sabrina, his daughter-in-law. You can smell and taste the love in this family operation.
The first thing we always look for is the diameter of the tree. We won't tap any tree that's less than 14 inches in diameter for every 4 inches above and beyond that. So if we go to an 18-inch diameter tree, we'll put two taps into that tree, and then so on and so forth. And we also take a look at the health of the tree. If it has a nice full canopy, we know that that's a real healthy tree. If it doesn't have any kind of scarring on the tree at all or anything like that, we'll choose that tree.
Mother Nature dictates all of sugaring season.
And so here in southern Indiana, we tap mid to late January. The season goes until about mid-March. We know to tap the trees when the days are getting up in the 40-degree range, but we want the nights to be cooler because the trees, when they expand and contract during those freezing periods, that's what sends the sap up and down the tree.
Each tap, we usually average about 10 gallons per year, each tap. So if one tree has three taps, we'll yield 30 gallons of sap out of one tree. Yeah. And then that's one of the reasons that pure natural syrup is so expensive, is because it is a long process to get from the sap to the table.
Earlier syrup in the season is generally lighter in color, or graded, it's a higher grade. And then later in the season, we have a darker syrup. For cooking, a lot of chefs like the grade B better just because it has a stronger flavor, more robust flavor in a finished dish. And the lighter syrup, or the grade A, is ideal for desserts, and I like it on my ice cream. And let's go ahead and try the grade A first. So here's the...
So I just had the grade A, and it's surprisingly perfumey. It just kind of, you know, I think a lot of taste comes from the aroma, and when that warms up in your mouth, and it's almost an explosion of flavor. Now I'm going to try the grade B, and the grade B has, it's more of a molasses kind of flavor, a touch of, just a little touch of bitterness, which I like.
A little earthier, a lot of people say.
Very, very different. I was surprised about how big of a difference there is between the grade A and grade B.
Pure maple syrup is just that. It's pure maple syrup. When the sap comes out of the tree, it's only at approximately 2% sugar content. When we cook it off and we condense it, we're taking it all the way up to about 58 to 60% sugar. And so there's no additives, there's no preservatives. It's pure. It's what we call nature's candy.
I would suggest that everybody take a chance if they can to go out and see maple being reduced and smell those smells. And it's just like the best perfume or cologne you could ever wear.
Burton's Maplewood Farm hosts the National Maple Syrup Festival in Medora, Indiana, on March 2nd, 3rd, 9th, and 10th. That's just one of many maple syrup events around the state this time of year. The Park County Maple Syrup Fair takes place February 23rd, 24th, and March 2nd and 3rd. And Leanne and Michael's Sugar Bush presents their annual Maple Syrup Festival in Salem, Indiana, February 23rd and 24th, and March 2nd and 3rd. Find links to these various maple syrup events at eartheats.org. Today is a beautiful day for tapping maple trees at the Hinkle Garten Farmstead in Bloomington, Indiana.
They were sitting on the table.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Michael Bell is the chair of the grounds committee at the farmstead. He's doing a demonstration for a dozen people about how to tap the ground's many mature sugar maple trees.
That's what we need right there.
Bell is trying to be reasonably authentic with how they would have collected sap back in 1886 when the property was first settled. The old-fashioned tap is 7/16 diameter with a hook from which the galvanized bucket and its lid will hang. Southern Indiana is experiencing ideal temperatures for the sap to start flowing, mid-20s at night to mid-40s during the day. During freezing temperatures, the tree draws in water from its roots. When the temperatures warm up, it expels sap. The freeze-thaw cycle will produce syrup-worthy sap until the tree grows buds. On days when these trees are really flowing, the 4-gallon buckets will be completely full.
I was just reading something the other day, as the old-timers called it, 100 drips a minute. Sort of like a heartbeat rate, where just kind of at that pace. And what we're looking at when we're tapping a tree is we want to start out with a minimum of 10 inches in diameter. If you go below that size, the tree isn't mature enough to be able to kind of handle that damage from year to year. And when the tree gets above about 16 inches in diameter, you can tap it up to 2 times. The bigger the tree, the more deeply furrowed the branches are, so it can be a little harder to find a spot that's going to give you access to the newest layer of cambium, which is where the sap is flowing. And right here, you can actually see one of our previous tap holes that's pretty well healed over. And this one, that was probably from last year. It would take about 3 years for that bark to completely cover that, to where you'd never see that anymore.
You want to drill 6 to 10 inches away from any old tap sites because the sap flow won't be as great near the spots where the tree is healing.
So, it looks like we've got a good spot right here that's open that would make sure the bucket would hang from. So I'll go ahead and get the drill out and give this guy a shot right here. So just fit it into the hole and start giving it a whack. And you'll notice a distinct change in tone when it's seated. Right there, it just kind of gets sort of a dead sound. So you know you've got it all the way in. And then from there, just find the hole in the bucket and get that hook over that, drop it in there. And it's ready to go.
Sounds easy enough to do yourself in your own backyard, right? Well, not so fast. Let's say you start with 10 gallons of sap in the hopes of getting 1 pint of syrup after boiling. Bell says there's a point where you go from taking a teaspoon of water out to get syrup, and you take that next teaspoon out and you have sludge. So perhaps maple syrup is best left to the professionals. The Hinkle Garten Farmstead is run by Bloomington Restorations Incorporated, thanks to Danielle and Michael Bell for their help. See photos of the tapping on our website, eartheats.org. Coming up, our juice recipe sort of looks like green sludge, but the kale and spinach are matched with sweet ingredients like pineapples and carrots.
You don't want to have a whole lot of just sugar in your juices, but you don't want to have something that's real bitter and you don't like. So the whole thing is about balancing those different flavors.
Finding harmony between the sweet and the bitter in your glass of juice, up next.
Got a wicked mind, Lord, I'm full of juice.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Chef Daniel Orr is a big fan of using maple syrup in all sorts of recipes. This first dish features turnips and pears. Root vegetables aren't necessarily the most intuitive foods to cook with, but don't be afraid to experiment with them like in this recipe. They're surprisingly versatile.
Well, turnips are great to just simply boil. You can boil them and mash them with butter. Again, I like to add a little bit of sweetness to them, like a honey or a molasses, to cut that kind of sulfur flavor that a lot of people don't like. You can grate the turnips and make turnip and potato pancakes. They come out much moister. They're less starchy. You can make turnip soups. You can use them in chicken soup. You know, toss them in where you'd use carrots. In France, they have what they call a navarin, and, usually made with lamb, spring lamb with baby turnips, which is really nice. So, yeah, they're great in those kind of, you know, stick-to-the-bone stews and meals like that.
So these turnips, they're pretty. They've got a little purple to them.
Purple tops and white bottoms.
And we're going to leave the skin on them. I'm just going to cut the tops and bottoms off of them and then cut them into kind of bite-sized pieces.
I'm trying to think what other food I eat that's purple naturally.
Yeah, there's not many. You think of blue foods, you can have blueberries, but this is a true purple haze color. All right, so we've got three turnips, and this will feed about six people, this recipe. So I'm going to put a little bit of apple juice in the pan. You could use apple cider. And what that's going to do is give you a little bit of sweetness.
As the radio kids retreat.
Okay, we're going to add a couple pears to that, about the same size cut. And it's good to use a Basque-style pear, or this is an Anjou pear. You want to use something that's a little firm. You don't want it to be too ripe. If it was too ripe, it's just going to turn to mush in the pan while it cooks. Okay, and we're going to just kind of cook those until they start to get tender. I'm going to go ahead and add my grade A maple syrup, which has a really nice, elegant flavor. Grade B maple syrup will be a little darker, maybe a little bit thicker, and a little more aggressive flavor. What we want to do is to reduce all those liquids down until it forms kind of a glaze that enrobes the pears and the turnips. And then we're going to finish it with a little bit of butter and lemon juice. So that will kind of round it all out. And what you're looking for whenever, we've talked about this before, are kind of those five senses. You want to taste a little sweet, a little bitter, a little salt, a little richness, a little acidity. So when you're asking yourself, what's this dish missing? You know, kind of go through those five flavor profiles, and then you can adjust accordingly. Okay, we'll just put a little bit of chopped herbs on it, and that is our ragu of turnips and pears with maple syrup and sweet seasoned spices.
Taste as you go is one of Chef Orr's rules to live by in the kitchen. It will be easy to do in our next recipe. This one goes out to all our Twitter followers who requested juice recipes a while back. This is a green juice, thanks to the kale, parsley, and spinach we're mixing in. But if you want more sweetness, add some extra pineapple, maybe another carrot. Or if you need to add more acid, add some orange juice. Taste and adjust as you go. Just use this recipe as a jumping-off point.
What you need to really remember is to balance your sweet and your kind of more savory vegetables. You don't want to have a whole lot of just sugar in your juices. But you don't want to have something that's real bitter and you don't like. So the whole thing is about balancing those different flavors. And you can really just go to the green market or to your local farmer's market and pick up whatever looks really, really fresh and then supplement it with some more traditional items from the regular grocery store.
We made two dishes with kale last week for our Valentine's Day episode, kale chips and a raw kale salad. So Chef grabbed a bunch of leftover kale from those recipes and blended it into this juice.
And so we're going to start with that. And I usually start with my vegetables that are a little coarser or drier. And then I push through the more moisture-full items like the cucumber and celery and things like that afterwards, so I'm sure to extract all the flavor and juices out of the drier vegetables. So we're going to put our kale in. I'm just going to push it down with the cucumber as my press. And I'm going to push another couple different types of kale. I've got some Tuscan kale, I've got some purple kale, as well as the more traditional curly green kale. And you don't want to put too much in your juicer at one time because then it just gets unmanageable and you'll have to clean it out every time you put a new vegetable in.
So I'm looking at this. On one side we have some juice coming out, some green goo, and on the other side it looks like leftover bits from the kale.
Right, and it's very, very dry and powdery. You can actually use some of those dried out pieces of vegetable and things like soups or stocks, if you'd like, so you don't have to waste that. Next, I'm going to add another flavoring, which is some ginger. And ginger is really great if you got a sore throat or not feeling that great. And some carrot. Carrot's going to give you a bit of sweetness.
So slowly but surely, we're getting juice.
Smell that ginger. When you put that ginger through, let's see if you can smell that.
The predominant smell is the kale at this point.
The kale, yeah. Okay, and we're going to add just a touch of sweetness with some pineapple. And that's going to be what makes it taste good.
And then you can throw whatever you want in. I've got some baby spinach, I've got some parsley, all those good green things.
So you're really telling me that this is going to taste good?
Well, I like it. You know, there is the one thing that if it makes you feel good and is healthy, then that should make it taste better, too. Okay, and then I'm just going to finish by pushing the cucumber through, and that's going to give us our volume. I'm going to finish it with a little bit of what I call my citrus trio, and that's just a little bit of lemon juice, lime juice, and orange juice. And that's going to give it a little bit of acidity, that nice orange flavor. Give it a little taste. Well, I think you're going to be pleasantly surprised. All right, we'll have a taste.
Cheers, everybody.
Santé.
One more quick recipe. Since we have the spinach already out, we can throw it together in this tasty Japanese salad.
We've got some soy sauce, a couple teaspoons of fish sauce, about a teaspoon of toasted sesame oil, and you can get those really in any big supermarket, but definitely at any ethnic market. They're kind of your secret arsenal. Add them to any of your dishes, and all of a sudden they start to taste a little more exotic. Basically, fish sauce is anchovies, fresh anchovies that are dried, and then they're covered with water and in barrels, and then left in the sun for about a year.
Doesn't that sound tasty, folks?
And it does smell strong, but it tastes great. And if you like Thai food, Vietnamese food, there's usually a little bit of fish sauce in those dressings. The sesame oil is made with white sesame seeds that are toasted and then pressed, so you get a toasted sesame flavor. So that's how that's made. About 2 tablespoons of sesame seeds. We're going to add some scallions. I'd say about three or four scallions. Okay, and then finally I'm going to add some ginger. Probably add about a teaspoon and a half. I'm cutting the ginger across the grain.
And you're not taking time to peel it?
No, when the ginger is young and the skin is smooth, you don't really need to peel it. Now, this is a dish you don't want to add like a citrus or lemon juice to it because it's going to discolor your spinach. You could always add a little bit at the end if you wanted to, but I don't think it's really necessary. Okay, we're going to toss our spinach in this.
That's what you're looking for?
Yeah, delicious.
Find all three of these recipes and many more on our website. In case you missed our 2 kale recipes from last week, you definitely should check those out. It's all at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Mike Bell, Aabon Binder, Sarah Gordon, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Mia Partlow, and everyone at Burton's Maplewood Farm and Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology, 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. And thanks to you for listening. Till next week, happy eating, folks. I'm Annie Corrigan.